Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is Cinco de Mayo, May 5th, 2026. And this is episode 604. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York State. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Support the show. Subscribe. Go to patreon.com/RadioWarNerd and support the show. And I'm on the line, of course, with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Britcher, back in Puglia, in the heel of the Italian peninsula. How you doing, John?
I'm okay. I remembered when you said that I was in Mexico City getting my teeth fixed, or so I thought, for Cinco de Mayo. Mm-hmm. And I made some innocuous remark about it, and people said, "No! Cinco de Mayo is a Puebla holiday. This is Mexico City. This is Gotham City, whatever." Right. And we don't do that square stuff. So I can't even remember the details.
I remember you wrote one or two really great pieces about it for NSFW Corp.
Yeah.
As I recall.
Yeah, it was made into a sort of book or booklet.
Right, right.
Yes. Called, I think, The Museum of Defeats.
Right.
But a lot of that was going down to the Museum of Mexican History. And going up to Chapultepec. Mm. But I was really surprised by that Cinco de Mayo thing. Like, it's a regional holiday. Somehow it got dragged up here.
Well, it's big. It's very big in for Mexican restaurants here. And
yeah.
Let me tell you, that's no small thing. Mexican restaurants are very important to one's livelihood. I mean, they bring joy.
I remember when you were in Czechia, you asked me for a care package that had nothing but Mexican food ingredients on it.
I don't remember that, but I definitely believe it. I miss it anywhere I go. Right. So today we are very excited to have another entry in the popular Warner U.S. Civil War series. And today's you're going to be talking about the Red River Campaign in 1864. But before we get to that, we should probably just briefly discuss some of the latest events out of the U.S.-Israel war on Iran, which was kind of in a sort of, warm ceasefire semi-hold, very, very, very reluctant, grumbling, unhappy hold from the American point of view.
Although I think there was a lot of relief in that. I mean, that when Hegseth says, something like the ceasefire is not over, he's desperately hoping that there will be some sort of extension on the ceasefire because it's finally getting through their elephantine skulls that, people don't like this very much.
Yeah, you are starting to see that. But at the same time, they're getting enormous pressure from the people who matter.
Right. This is just a people who don't matter thing.
Yes, exactly. Enormous pressure. Plus, Trump is so obsessed with being the greatest president in history. The greatest president in history does not have on his record, check mark, lost war to mid-sized power,
yeah.
and gave up after 6 weeks. Like,
that in let his alone mind, the other stuff.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, Epstein. I mean, there's so much stuff there. But so I feel like, I think you're right. I think probably Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, has been trying to break through to Trump's, little brain about how damaging all this is, the war, that is. So, they agreed to the ceasefire the ceasefire in early April in order to get out of a trap, a situation where Trump had boxed himself completely in with threats of, you know, wiping Iran completely off the map and then not fulfilling that as with a lot of other threats. And so he just agreed to everything. And then as soon as the ceasefire was agreed, he started going back on it.
Right.
From my point of view, so all of a sudden he's decided, well, then the next thing they did was the blockade of Iran's blockade, right? And
was a mind puzzler.
Well, yeah, so this was pushed by the same people who pushed the same kind of Iran war lobby that is mostly kind of gathered, or at least kind of the epicenter of it, is in this think tank, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, FDD, which is an Israeli lobby front group, basically. Originally, its original papers, as I've said before, that it filed with the IRS described it as an organization dedicated to improving Israel's image. And then it became about promoting democracy, of course. And Mark Dubowitz, who's the head of the FDD, you know, he's kind of served as like the way Bill Kristol was the big sort of mouthpiece and cheerleader for everything that went on in the Iraq War. That's Dubowitz's role in this. And it was the FDD, but not just the FDD. I think there were others like Richard Haass, who's kind of the grandee of the foreign policy establishment, Council on Foreign Relations guy. There were a lot of people, because it was very hard for the foreign policy class to accept that the U.S. had just blatantly lost a really stupid war.
It is still very, very hard for them.
Hard,
and
yeah.
And you can't help gloating about that
a little bit. So they all kind of coalesced around this idea of blockading Iran. It was another one of these four-dimensional chess moves. So we're going to blockade Iran. And then the theory was that was being put out by the FDD and some of their Pahlavist, they have a whole stable of these like Iranian diaspora monarchists who they're like Chalabi.
Oh, that guy with two M names.
Yeah,
I forget.
Miad Maliki or something like that. Yeah,
yeah, that's it.
He was saying, you know, that he said in mid-April that in 13 days, Iran's oil pipelines would start to explode because they had nowhere to offload the oil that's being pumped, and you can't just turn this stuff off. So it would all back up and explode. And then at the end of April, Trump bragged on Fox News that all of Iran is going to blow up in 3 days, all of its entire, oil and gas infrastructure, like just complete nonsense. And then it didn't happen. And so at that point, they were just like, well, Trump just realized, he's not happy with the situation now. He doesn't want to start the full war, though he keeps threatening to. So he has to do something. So he announced Operation Freedom. These names are incredible.
These names are so clunky.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. And not just the names.
I'm sorry, I'm wrong. Project Freedom. Project Freedom.
Yeah. See, I thought that was Project Freedom. But then I thought, wait, or does that mean Operation Project Freedom?
Yes.
They're starting to run out of nouns, and they could be noun-verb thing. I don't know anymore.
Hegseth said today that this involves draping the Strait of Hormuz in the colors red, white, and blue. Hooah! it's just... So he announced Project Freedom. And what he was going to do was break the Iranian break the blockade was the idea. He was going to break the blockade. And as far as I could tell, the only blockade he broke was his own blockade. So there's a lot of theater going on right now, too, in this, right? Because so the Trump administration has made a lot of show and noise about having escorted with the U.S. Navy using guided missile destroyers or whatever, escorted two tankers, two of the hundreds and hundreds of tankers in the Gulf, two of them out. And it seems like, so Iran fired a few drones at it and they were shot down. And it doesn't seem to be what Iran, it doesn't seem like Iran really tried that hard.
Yeah.
Because they know that if they hit the U.S. Navy, that it will mean the war starting up. And it, even though Iran has the upper hand, like it will hurt.
Yeah.
So it, you know, you don't want to be forced to do it. So instead the UAE becomes the punch, you know, the sort of the person you work on. It's like the third person you work on to prove to the second person you mean business.
Yep.
You know, it's kind of what's happening. And the UAE has done everything to encourage themselves as being that punching bag. I mean, they are endlessly yapping about, and they're, you know, they just broke away from OPEC, and they're trying to push everybody to go to full-scale war with Iran, because the UAE's model has suffered by far the hardest of all these countries in the region. Their model, I mean, kind of ironically, the fact that the UAE diversified its economy, its whole political economy, whatever you call it, so much, unlike a lot of these other oil-producing countries, it actually, in this kind of war, made it far more vulnerable, because the UAE depends on being a safe haven. I mean, there's just
if you are willing to pay for a visa or just an outright passport, you can go to one of those developments that now look embarrassingly cheesy, like the one that's in the island that's in the outline of a palm tree just off the shore. Suddenly that looks kind of dumb.
Dumb and vulnerable. I mean, the model's broken. You know, as they say, the idea of Dubai, I mean, I don't know how it ever comes back. And I think they know it, and they're just lashing out. They still have a lot of money. They have a lot of weapons and a lot of mercenaries. But you can't put the Humpty Dumpty back together, which is safety. Like, that's kind of gone at this point. Yeah. So what we saw yesterday was the U.S. kind of testing the ceasefire limits, and Iran responding by sending salvos of missiles and drones at not just at the UAE, but at Fujairah. And that's, I think, really important here, because Iran, just before that, they also released a new map showing what they consider to be the zone of the Strait of Hormuz. And they didn't consider it just to be like along their coast or X amount of miles off of their coast. They drew a direct line where the UAE is, and then there's this little Omani exclave there. It's like a peninsula that juts up into the Strait of Hormuz across from Iran. On the west side of it, which is where the Persian Gulf is, there's a line drawn all the way down to the UAE, from Iran down to the UAE coast. And then on the east side in the Gulf of Oman, there's a line that goes from Iran to the port city of Fujairah. This is their only UAE port city on the, you know, on the exit part, on the outer part of the Strait of Hormuz. This is how they're supposed to be. This is their big, you know, checkmate move, how they're supposed to be able to get their oil and gas and products out without having to traverse, you know, Iran's stated like zone there. But it all this map stuff only means something if Iran doesn't have the capability of hitting Fujairah, which they obviously do and just did and demonstrated it and caused real damage. And that's the reality. Like, that's right. The reality.
There were tabloid headlines of the shore burning. I mean, refineries or tankers on the shore burning yesterday. And I can't swear to where it was, but in a way—
It was Fujairah.
Right. Yeah. In a way, with the audience of those tabloids, it doesn't much matter. People get the idea that, you know, something went wrong. Although, given what Trump said, they might have the idea that it's some kind of 1920s slapstick cartoon with the storage tanks just getting more and more full, just dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun- that whole cartoon engineering thing hasn't happened.
You know, I think Trump, so he said 3 days at the end of April. Just yesterday, he said 13 days.
Yeah.
Because that's what the FDD people are now telling him, 13 days.
Well, they specialize in that. Didn't Triple M or whatever his name is have to erase his first draft of a deadline? And then say,
he modified it, definitely. Yes, he moved the goalposts, as they say. Yes. Yeah, he basically accused Iran of cheating by storing their oil in places that they weren't supposed to, according to his analysis. Basically cheating by improvising.
Right, yeah.
Damn you, you can't improvise this against the rules. You know,
Iran, you put this oil in a big, deep pit. It's supposed to be in an aluminum tank.
Yeah, it's you know, they know this shit. They know what's going on. And Trump, of course, how does Trump respond to getting all of this endless series of bullshit pro-war propaganda and advice? And he is listening to them. I mean, I saw the White House once directly in response to a journalist saying something went wrong through social media, the White House responded with a screenshot of FDD propaganda. Right. You're wrong, because look at this. And Trump just hired one of the FDD's flacks to join the negotiating team with Iran. Yeah. So they're just failing up and up and up here.
Well, yeah, and up is very much the word, because there's an open disdain for what Trump used to call very flatteringly ordinary Americans. And they've stopped hiding that. Like, you don't count very much. You're nice and you're ordinary and we need your vote occasionally, but don't mess in things that are over your head.
He's not interested.
He's
fine. Yeah, I think he just did a pitch stop or something at the Villages in Florida, which is one of these grotesque MAGA retirement communities, like mega retirement communities. And I don't have the quotes in front of me, but it was, he was telling whoever was joining with him, he was quoted as saying basically, as one of his aides was talking to him about Medicare and Medicaid and the different things that would, you know, be important to a retirement community and his base at the retirement community. He said, all this Medicare, Medicaid stuff is boring me. Just stop it already. Yeah, it's just, he doesn't care. Yeah, I know. I think, you know, what we've seen is, just a quote here. Let's see what happened since the ceasefire. Or just in the last 2 days, I guess, Iran's fired at commercial vessels 9 times, seized 2 container ships, attacked U.S. forces more than 10 times. And the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, said, quote, all of this is below the threshold of restarting major combat operations at this point. So they're saying, I mean, the U.S. clearly also doesn't want to, at least not yet, resume the hot war, because it's going badly.
Very badly. I mean, that's one thing that I noticed about the news cycle in this crisis. The word Hormuz is all over the place. The word Iran is not. It's as if they aim too high and the idea of Iran finally got to them, and they saw its size and its history of resisting invasion, and they got a little dizzy. And it was just, let's just do Hormuz.
Yes. Let's focus just on little Hormuz there. So I don't know. This could easily spiral out of control for all kinds of reasons. I mean, they are definitely closer to a trigger point where it will start to spiral out of control. Although Iran does not want it to go all the way full hot, it is different than the Ali Khamenei Iran. It is not afraid of answering, of answering with real kinetic responses.
Right.
And they're very hell bent or dead set on repeatedly demonstrating that.
And they're also and much funnier than Trump has ever been in his life. I mean, those Lego videos. By the way, how do your kids react to them, Mark?
They've seen a little bit of it, but I think they find the politics of it a bit confusing.
Right.
I mean, my oldest son in general, though, just he hates Trump so much that he refuses to stand or say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning at school. You have to do, you know, we're in public schools here and you have to do it. And he just refuses to because he thinks it's bowing to Trump. And they don't make him, which is good, you know.
Yeah.
But he just absolutely on principle refuses to. And
well, good for him then.
So last thing I want to say before we get to it is this, which I think is an interesting poll. I'll give you my thoughts on it or my read on it. 61% of Americans say the Iran war is a mistake. This is a new WAPO ABC poll. In Iraq, it took 3 years before 61% of Americans said the Iraq war was a mistake. And boy, it took 3 years. It's pretty crazy because it was clear after the first year of what a complete disaster it was. But already 6 in 10, including 79% of so 19% of Republicans and 71% of independents say it's a mistake. Those are not great numbers. But here's, I think, from my point of view, kind of the other, let's say, really interesting sub-question to that, which is, at this time, do you think the U.S. should make a peace deal, even if it results in a worse deal for the U.S., which is where we're at now, or push Iran for a better deal, even if it means resuming U.S. military action against Iran? And statistically, Americans, it's 48-46. It's a statistical tie, which is to say that a not insignificant chunk of those who say the war was a mistake also are in favor of resuming that mistake in the hopes that it won't end up the same way. And I think it's just nobody likes losing a war.
Yeah, and Americans have that very strange pattern. I mean, it was very evident in Vietnam. Oh, it's a total disaster, but yeah, of course we got to go through with it.
Yep. And I think, who's a friend of the show, Joe Costello, was telling me, Pat Cadell, who was like the first kind of really famous, you know, modern political pollster whiz, like political whiz. He was Carter's guy in the 70s. He hung out with Hunter Thompson. You'll find him in his books like The Great White Shark Hunt. I think he helped write Carter's malaise speech, which kind of helped doom Carter. But anyway,
put malaise into circulation there.
But Pat Cadell had always said that in the confusion, like this would be chalked up as people, you know, the confusion portion of the poll. So the confusion is where all the action is in politics. And I would bet you, I think that's relevant because I'll bet you anything this is what the political operatives in the Trump White House are thinking, reading these polls. Okay, they think it's a mistake, but they don't want you to lose this thing. They're willing to go with it again. Of course, the problem is you go with it again and it's going to end up even worse than before. So they're kind of in a pickle here.
Yeah, very much in a pickle, but it's a distant sort of pickle. And most of them are really too old to be threatened by it. And they don't really care if it's just a coalition of industry and special interest groups that's really pushing Trump. They think that's normal and fine.
Yeah, speaking of old, last thing, and we'll get to, I'm really looking forward to this, resuming the U.S. Civil War. But speaking of old, this is like, I don't know what level of weird satire this is, but Jake Tapper on CNN had Barney Frank, old Barney Frank, the old Democratic Party hack, who he's in like hospice care. He's dying. He looks dead. I don't know. It looks like, you know, they
much thinner.
Him.
I'll say that.
Yes. Yeah. Much thinner because he's dying. And on his deathbed, you know, his last gasping words were basically, Ban trans people from sports, Democrats. This is my parting advice to you. Bash trans people. This is from one of the, you know, a gay Democrat who was one of the early gay Democrats or Congress people to come out of the closet, or he was forced out of the closet because he was caught in a gay prostitute scandal. And here he is, like, his parting wisdom was to bash trans people if you want to get back in power. And it just the whole spectacle of CNN bringing him on to get this wisdom from this dying, you know, dying Democrat centrist in a party that is...
Yeah, who's the guy who has a head like a skull and wears a baseball cap? He's sort of the same.
Oh, yeah, Carville. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I guess as you die, you look more and more like Carville, because Barney Frank does look like Carville a little bit. All right. Enough of the present tense. Let's go back to the wonderful past tense.
Couldn't be any worse.
Yes.
Well, no. you can decide on that after.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Red River Expedition. John, how do you want to introduce it?
Well, I started getting into it by way of a writer we both revere. And that's, of course, the Charles Portis, the writer of True Grit, Dog of the South, which is his best novel as far as I'm concerned, Gringos, and that one that scares me too much because it's about the...
Masters of Atlantis, you mean?
Yeah, Masters of Atlantis. And
I'm not sure it's as scary later, because when I read it in my later 20s, I think was the first time, I can't remember if I could finish it, but boy, did that bring me down hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I reread parts of it many, many years later when, I don't know, different things bother me now than bothered me then. And it was kind of more fun. And I know other people thought it was fun. And I don't know, maybe it was just at a particular moment. Maybe if I read it again, I'd be terrified again. But,
well, yeah, but yeah. I mean, I just remember, I'm sure it had to do with what was going on or not going on in my so-called academic career, because I remember there's one scene in which all these losers are sprawled out in recliner chairs to sleep in, and I just thought, oh, God, I'm sitting in one right now.
Yes.
That's not good.
Yeah. What was also kind of scary was it felt like Portis had kind of slipped from comedy, which is always so close, to just pure
hate.
Yes, yeah. Pure hate. Pure kind of, I don't know, nihilism or something. Or
yeah, I remember there's one scene with... a lot of lawyers, and it feels like an excursion, like he's going out of his way to introduce characters he wants to bash, and it didn't feel right. But anyway, he writes about the Arklatex, the Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas area, which is in a way the protagonist of his earliest novel, Norwood, which is also a great novel. And there are all kinds of details in Portis's writing that involve the invasion or advance by the Union forces on the Arklatex, that is centered on northern Louisiana, centered on Shreveport, not the New Orleans part of Louisiana at all.
Because the Union took it early on, right?
Yeah. Not the Union took it very early on, and there was almost no infantry involvement because, I mean, at that time and almost through the war, the Confederate infantry tended to be superior, but they couldn't compete on navigable rivers, and that navigable part is very important in terms of the Red River, which flows through the big town in northwestern Louisiana, Shreveport. The Red River is navigable sometimes. And then, as it turns out, when the locals don't want it to be navigable, and this was something the union had not realized, they can just knock out a few ditches and fences, and it's not navigable anymore. In fact, they had some very big cannon-bearing ships, which were just too big for the river halfway through. And no one really knew that the Red River could be drained of all its water. But to the little promotion for Portis, I gotta say, there's a couple of great notions in Forrest. He is a hardcore Confederate, and by the way, that's typical of the Arc Latex, and I think it's typical of the regions of the Confederacy that were never quite conquered. I mean, Northern Virginia, for example, was the scene of endless bloody battles, but Northern Virginia is also a purple zone at the moment. Mm-hmm. That is not true at all of Northern Louisiana or of the adjacent states that make up the Arc Latex. That is Louisiana, Arkansas, and above all, Texas. They are deep red and will probably be until the sun goes out. So they, despite the fact that they defeated a northern invasion, they were hardcore Confederate well into the 20th century and maybe into the 21st. Portis is a loyalist of the Arc Latex, which is a sort of awkward position, mainly because of the rather obscene racist policies that were mixed up in it. But in his first hit novel, True Grit, the character Rooster Cogburn, the John Wayne guy, his cat is named General Sterling Price. General Sterling Price was, of course, a real Confederate commander, leader of a couple of bizarre invasions of Missouri. Price had this fixed idea that Missouri is ripe for invasion, and nope, not that time. Well, let's try it again. No, not that time either. And Norwood, at the beginning of the novel, you'll remember this, Mark, I think, hears about, from Grady Fring, the local con man, the history of Stonewall Jackson's Shenandoah Valley campaign. He brags about beating somebody on a trade, and Norwood says, "Did you beat him on that trade?" And Grady Fring says, "Yes, I confess that I did. I took him like Stonewall Jackson took Nathaniel Banks in the Valley of Shenandoah. That is to say, decisively."
Yes, that is to say, decisively.
And Nathaniel P. Banks, who we have to introduce now, was, for those who don't know him yet, a complete idiot, one of the many idiots in the Civil War who was rewarded for his loyalty to roughly Lincoln and Republican Unionist policies. He was a bobbin boy from the New England mills, and it was a respectable origin. I mean, he was a working class kid who made good, but making good is not the same as making a general, and he should never have attempted that. His war record was just appalling. He looked like a conductor on an old-time railroad, and most conductors could have out-strategized him any day. After the Shenandoah debacle, I mean, Stonewall Jackson versus Nathaniel Banks, that was just cruel. that wasn't even like, you know, a semi-pro team versus the NFL champions. That was just sadistic. So he was given another assignment because they weren't ready to fire him yet. He was too useful politically. So his job was, as part of a complex campaign, to build on the taking of New Orleans by taking the one big city in northwestern Louisiana. You don't think much of northwestern Louisiana, and you don't think very often of it, and that's about right. I mean, it's not a big area. But Shreveport, which also features in many of Portis's books, is a very big figure in that world. And all his protagonists say at some point or other, I'm not from the crawdad-eating New Orleans part of Louisiana. I'm from the...
Right.
The Shreveport part, and he says people don't like that because they think it has no humor, or if it has humor, it's of the sweaty, cruel kind, which, by the way, is sort of true of all his books. So he actually gets dumped by Beth. The cool, yuppie sort of Mayan specialist for being from the wrong part of Louisiana. Portis takes things
really... Shreveport is, I mean, put it this way, the New Orleans part, at least I don't know what it's like now, but when I visited it once or twice a few decades ago, it really felt like a different world from that area and really from a lot of America. Like the cultural influences, they're just kind of a lot more prominent. And the people there thought they were just regular middle Americans, I think, but they didn't, I don't know, nobody else kind of thought that. They didn't seem to really fit in with Texas, Arkansas. I'm talking about sort of the New Orleans area. But
right.
When you go all the way to the other corner, so, you know, New Orleans is in the very southeastern corner and Shreveport's in the northwestern corner. Then you're really talking about Arkansas, Texas.
Yeah, Arklatex. Kind of world. That's Portis's world, or what he claims to be his world. Truth is, Portis went to New York and worked for the New York Times for a few years. But I think he came of age during the civil rights struggle, and although he kept a very strict radio silence about the results of that change, he had a lot of bitterness about it. Is, as I said, or at least sort of hinted, typical of the few unconquered diehard areas of the Confederacy, like East Texas, Northern Louisiana. And there was a 20th century historian named Ludwell Johnson, originally from West Virginia, who became a specialist in the Red River Campaign and talked about it as a way of making money through cotton confiscation. And there's no doubt that some of the sleazier commanders in that expedition did try to make a sideline out of seizing bales of cotton and selling them because it was white gold, as they said at the time. I mean,
yes.
800 pounds of cotton, and there's 800 pounds in a bale, made you an awful lot of money when those mills in the English Midlands started to run out of raw material. Mm-hmm. But right. It's kind of odd that Ludwell Johnson never waxes eloquent, and he does wax kind of eloquent in a snotty way in all his books about Northern invaders making use of the cotton, about the original cotton planters who enslaved everybody on their labor force, paid them exactly zero, just enough to buy a miserable slave diet, literally, and encompassed 100% of the profits.
And refused to pay taxes.
Yeah.
This was their one principle. They were willing to give up their sons to die before they would pay taxes to the Confederacy.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of like, you know, it's like what the mobsters say in Casino. Otherwise, what's the point?
You know? Anyway, it is a very strange righteousness that old Ludwell has. It's much like, well, you don't criticize Southerners because of the Civil War era, because they just said so outright and they never hit it. Well, that doesn't account for all sins, you know.
Yeah.
You can be perfectly frank about something and still be a bastard.
We're living through that right
now.
yeah.
That's so
how much good that's doing.
The job of Nathaniel P. Banks was to go from his debacle, his utter debacle in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia to northern Louisiana and Texas and try to open that place up, whether for cotton profits or for many other reasons, such as the fact that all the aristocrats in the low-lying cotton plantation areas around Vicksburg fled once the Union armies flooded into the area and went to Texas, which became then a very, in contemporary terms, deep red area. One of those was a diarist who I included in a newsletter about Confederate diarists long ago. Her name was Kate Stone. Kate Stone. You may remember her from the newsletters. Stone was a Southern patriot. She was young and had a lot of enthusiasm. And that must have hurt, because if you were an enthusiast for the Confederate cause and you were like 18 or 19, which she was at the time, you had maybe a couple of years to get married. And if that didn't happen, it was not so good. And so many of her entries involve saying, well, if I was willing to compromise, et cetera, I could have had that guy. And so she remembered the war as, quote, dashing young officers in magnificent uniforms. And in 1862, because those dashing young men, her brothers, had all gone to Virginia for the war, two things happened. First, those two brothers turned up on the casualties list. They were dead. Mm-hmm. And second, Union raiding parties started to menace her plantation, which was called Broken Burn. It was in the lowlands outside of Vicksburg. So the whole family just took off, piled everything they could in wagons, although even that was kind of scary, and they moved to East Texas. She never really learned to like Texas and describes its rude manners with very little sympathy.
I think you have to have been born there a generation or two to ever like it.
Yeah.
I mean, does anybody
you didn't
like
it, as I recall.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. So she mentions her brother's death, and it's just a bad time for her. She doesn't return until 1865, and then she finds the family plantation in ruins. So she had a really bitter life, and that contributed to her views on the war, which were fanatically pro-Confederate. This was a common fate for a lot of the upper class of that area. They are often described as inhabiting the Delta. It took me, by the way, a confession. It took me about two decades to realize that when they're talking about the Mississippi Delta, they're not talking about, you know, that thing downstream of New Orleans. They're talking about Delta Blues. They mean the lowlands around Vicksburg.
Right.
And I could never quite understand that. These people they had a lot of money if they managed to bring it with them, and they had a lot of political capital, and they became the new elite in an area of northern Louisiana, eastern Texas, and southern Arkansas. And Nathan Banks was assigned to get rid of that. He was possibly the worst of major commanders in the Union Army, though there are a lot of rivals for that. Talk about team of rivals. They could very easily have a competition for team of rivals for the worst commanding officer.
That raises possibilities of a team of rivals, but in the Trump administration.
SCTV
Kennedy
sense.
And Hex. Yes, exactly. I'm a rival. You know, so you have Bobby Kennedy and Hexeth and all these weirdos. Is this because that area, once Grant took Vicksburg, so they had Vicksburg and then they had New Orleans, they had, strategically done a lot of the work already. So I'm just wondering, is that a reason why maybe it just wasn't as hugely important to the Union? So they send out, the third stringer to go take this area?
He was valuable in some political sense. He started out as a mill worker. It's one of those rags to riches story in which, unfortunately, the guy is a complete idiot. But he was a mill worker who started out as Bobbin Boy Banks. That was his political slogan. And he just collected the bobbins at the end of the process of whatever. Like when I used to collect the unused copies of the Contratus Times and pile them on a pallet, although I never quite achieved a political success. But that was my job, and he had roughly the same job.
He became commander of the Warner Legion, John.
Where were you? I never thought of that. But anyway, they not only had important victories, but those important victories came within a day of each other. Gettysburg ended with a Confederate defeat July 3rd. Vicksburg surrendered because commander, a northern man who was another complete idiot, said, well, maybe they'll be nicer to us and give us easier terms. They didn't, but it didn't matter because Grant had planned to give them easy terms, kill them with kindness all along. Within 2 days in 1863, in the summer of 1863, the war should have been broken wide open. And various Union officers say this in a puzzled way, like, you can't give up the Mississippi and have your army decimated in its one invasion, in its second invasion of the North, with, and then just pretend you're okay. The one thing that you can do after that, and they knew this even at the time, younger officers were proposing it to Robert E. Lee all the way up to Appomattox. The one thing you could do is go guerrilla. And mm-hmm. and they said this, why don't we just take to the hills? And for once in his life, Lee had a lot of grim common sense. And he said, mm-hmm. do you realize what that will cost the civilian population?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that a lot of occupying armies haven't realized even now, or if they realize it, they are all in favor of it. 'Cause guerrilla war is a real nightmare for the people who are ostensibly on the guerrilla side. So he was, he surrendered and it was over, but it really was about 2 years late. I mean, the Mississippi was gone. The chance of invading the North was gone. It was just a matter of hanging on, especially after Sherman's march to a small territory. They just had a lot of determination, if not a lot of savvy. So part of that attempt to take a first step in smashing into this heartland, the Arklatex, was given to the naval commander, mm-hmm. David Dixon Porter, a very good commander, and he had a tremendous fleet, frankly, just too big for the river. If you look, and I'll put this all in the notes for the show, if you look at the banks of the Red River, the one that flows through Shreveport, it's a miserable river. It's shallow, muddy. It's not. It's called the Red River for a reason. It's
It actually looks red.
It
looks just very like mushy. It looks very mushy. I guess
walked off a boat, you would sink up to your hips in a couple steps.
My son was learning a song on the piano, Red River Valley. Now I think it's an old folk song or something.
I mean, there's several. I looked into that. There's several Red Rivers, but that probably is the Red River, the same one.
It must be, yeah.
Red River Valley and the cowboy who loved you so true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
So, yeah, it probably marks a period of emigration to the West because that soil never really proved out as a big earner. So this big naval force was supposed to intimidate the hell out of the Confederates' local commanders, and it did in a way, but they weren't sailors after all.
Right.
So Richard Taylor was a son of he was a Confederate commander, but son of Zachary Taylor, a United States president. And he was considered a competent guy, prickly like a lot of Southern officers were. Very jealous of his honor and hated his subordinates for the most part. Commanded a large force of about 20,000 with many Cajun fighters in it. French was a major language of that army, along with English, of course. And him going up about against Banks was another mismatch. I mean, Banks versus almost anybody, Elmer Fudd, would have been a mismatch. And he decided to oppose the force south of the big city of Shreveport, really the only city in northern Louisiana. And he massed about his 20,000 or so forces there. The fourth composition was a little strange. Now, remember, there were about 30,000, maybe 35,000 men who'd surrendered at Vicksburg roughly a year ago, a year from this point. And a lot of them fought again. They weren't supposed to do that, but Southern apologists tend to gloss that over just the way they do slavery and some other stuff. They fought well, and many of them were Texans. The site of the battle was called the Sabine Crossroads, and he went into the battle suddenly because it was a meeting encounter. Meeting encounters are where two armies converge on a site. In a way, Gettysburg was a gigantic meeting encounter, and it was handled as sloppily as they usually are. A lot of them, meeting encounters, I mean, exemplify Nathan Bedford Forrest's dictum, get there first with the most men. I do not subscribe to the idea that he said in his cornpone way, get there firstest with the mostest. That's pure Hollywood as far as I can tell. But
more like Looney Tunes.
Yeah, actually, that would be good.
Kind of Yosemite Sam.
Yeah.
You get there the first with the mostest.
Yeah. And he was actually, Forrest is a scary guy. He's nobody to fuck with, as they say. So anyway, his dictum was not followed by either commander. Taylor had a lot of problems with logistics and getting his people up in time for the battle. He laid his forces out. A lot of them were Texans, which in 1860 means, unless they're very dispirited, that they were scary people. I mean, Grant says this in his experience about the invasion of Mexico. There are something like, there are many Texans I would not have liked to meet in a dark alley or something like that. And they fought bitterly. The Union forces, aside from one division of Sherman's force, which would soon go across the South in the big March to the Sea, they were not especially elite troops, and God knows they had anything but an elite commander. So they lost the first battle, and there were significant casualties. 120 killed, basically, 600 wounded, 1,500 captured, 20 cannons lost, 156 wagons, horses, mules.
This is the Battle of Sabine Crossroads?
Yeah. Yeah, which will become the Battle of all things, Pleasant Hill.
yes, I saw.
So on April 8th, 1864, the Union Army was marching toward the city of Shreveport, but they never really got there. Banks was leading them, and that was quite enough disabilities. Porter's fleet of gunboats was accompanying them, but they were having a lot of trouble already with the water level in the Red River.
Yeah, I was going to say, it looks shallow.
Very shallow. Shallower than they ever expected, because they only knew the river before Confederate saboteurs had the idea of, like, let's knock out a few levees and see what happens to those big giant ships. So they met the Confederates at the Battle of what became known as Mansfield. And it was a chaotic battle on the morning of April 8th. It was a meeting encounter. That is, the armies are just massing when they run into each other. And those battles are very tricky to handle because, you know, commanders are coming in one by one. No one quite knows who's in charge. You need a strong commander to do that. Taylor was a much stronger commander than his opposite number, Nathaniel Banks, and he got his forces up to the line and charged. Now, the Union forces had a lot of artillery, and they were loaded as is usual in cases like that in the Civil War, with grapeshot, and they blasted that advance. But this was still a relatively early Confederate battle. So the Confederates were kind of crazy and fierce, and they just plowed through the Union forces and ran down the road after them. That battle gave way to the next one, which was simply down the road, when at a point further down the road, that is south of the original Battle of Mansfield, the Union forces stopped and gave battle at last. They'd been stopped by an officer who was in charge of massing the survivors, and he did a really good job. And they inflicted a lot of casualties on the advancing Southerners, but they still lost, mostly because, just like his exemplar George McClellan, Nathaniel P. Banks always retreated. He's like, did we win? Yes. Retreat. Did we lose? Retreat. Did we not show up? Whatever. Retreat. So in spite of the fact that they had bled the Confederate force very heavily and were holding their own, the Union forces fled, or, you know, they didn't flee, but they retreated pretty damn quickly. They had casualties, 115 killed, almost 600 wounded, and 1,500 captured. But the Confederate forces had just about equal casualties. Now, this has only come out recently because you'll find in the early days of the Civil War that Confederate casualties are always underreported, if they're reported at all. Some Confederate armies were in no shape to file any efficient paperwork. Union armies were much better at that. And they also didn't like having to admit that they'd lost a lot of people.
Because they had the smaller smaller population also.
Yeah,
right?
So yeah, they could not afford it. Whereas, frankly, right, there was an endless supply of cannon fodder coming in from...
It's kind of like Ukraine and Russia in that sense.
You know, yeah.
There's a lot of counting, and I think generally over-exaggerated counting often of Russian casualties, which are large anyway. But one of the big propaganda angles in the Ukraine war is just to suppress Ukraine casualties.
Yeah, that's been a pretty open campaign by Western media. It's kind of surprised me. But there are a lot of surprises for everybody who... as a hobby of news consuming at the moment.
Yeah.
So that battle formed into a second battle that really is part of the same battle. It's on the same day, just 15 miles down the road. And that was the Battle of Pleasant Hill, which was mostly fought the next day. As the night went by, Confederates came up against this new Union line and found it too formidable to attack. So as they gathered all their reinforcements, the Union troops did roughly the same thing. And they had, when this battle started the next day, April 9th, 1864, the Union had maybe 25,000 people. The Southern forces had probably about the same number. And Taylor gathered them up, formed them into lines, and sent them into battle against the Union fortifications, which had been reinforced by new cannon. The Union forces had a lot of cannon, and they were all charged with grapeshot. And grapeshot is what soldiers feared most. If you've ever seen a grapeshot round, it's a horrifying thing. It's a bunch of metal balls with a cheap base metal link to them, and that gets shredded when the cannon fires, and these balls go all over the place, much like several anti-personnel mines in recent history, or the battle shotguns that are very often used. They're giant shotguns, and
there's that new American missile, precision missile. It was just tested, first field tested on Iranian female volleyball players, fires tungsten balls when it.
Yeah.
So it went. Yeah.
The Confederates didn't have the money for tungsten balls. They had to
no.
deal with cheap pot metal, but gets the job done.
Yeah.
They just kept coming. I mean, that was in many battles early in the war, and this is really the first battle in this Arklatex area, so it is for these people early in the war. The Confederates just had real esprit de corps, real ferocity, and they tended to outshine their Union counterparts in that way. The one corps that really did well is the black troops, African American military units who had been recruited from Louisiana, mostly after the capture of New Orleans. These were not necessarily ex-slaves, because these were often from the what was called colored population of New Orleans, which was substantial, even in the days before the Union troops arrived, and because, you know, various owners, so-called, would grant their ex-slaves freedom on their deathbeds, and the Confederacy would grudgingly go along with that. So many of them, hundreds in fact, recruited their friends and their colleagues to form a Union army force. And in one of the more shameful episodes of the occupation, they were refused and told to go home because they might upset local sensibilities. But many of them formed a new Union unit, which they called the Corps d'Afrique, and they went north with Banks, which was a brave thing to do anytime, anywhere. And they fought extremely well, holding the right side of the battle line. The Confederate cavalry, which was always a pretty formidable body of men, rolled up the left of the Union Army. But then the Union Army simply pivoted and led by this Corps d'Afrique, fired back into the Confederates who were attempting to surround them and just drove them off. I mean, if you have a large infantry force, the lesson of the Civil War is that if they don't panic and hold onto their rifles, you can shred any number of cavalry that is advancing on you. So they did. And that ended the battle. After that, Nathaniel P. Banks retreated. First, one day's ride south, and then completely. And this was just too much, even for his many backers in Congress. They said, you won that thing. Why did you retreat before you got to Shreveport? And he didn't have much of an answer. He was a well-meaning man. He looked after his troops, but he was pretty helpless. But the real impact of this battle was much, much later. And that's why I talked about Charles Portis and his novels at the beginning of the show, because Portis grew up in the mid-20th century when the memory of these people was still very strong. And as one writer on the battle has said, quote, its most far-reaching effect was to cement a strong Confederate ethos in North Louisiana. The Southern families who endured the campaign and suffered its consequences remained unvanquished, as William Faulkner might have written. Their side had won, and they never forgot it. Because their side effectively did win in Civil War terms. Mm-hmm. They occupied the ground of the battle, and the Union fled. So that was enough for them. Many people have focused, especially Southern writers of the pro-Confederate side, on the cotton-stealing motives of this invasion, as they call it. There's no proof that Banks or any of his officers had venal motives in mind. The naval officers were a little more inclined to ask, hey, how much you want for that cotton, if they saw it standing at the dock? Because they had, you know, a bale of cotton weighs 800 pounds. If you've got a...
And they can transport it to market, right?
I mean, that's a...
Yeah, they're always
either you've got
in
the Incredible Hulk on your squad or... or you're going to have to leave it, whereas these guys could take it out on a boat. And as I said, I don't need to repeat it, but it's a little ridiculous to imply that person A, who's of the wrong ideology, tries to grab a couple of bales of cotton when person B, who is of your valued ideology, has been getting all the profits of it, and in many cases, selling the people who harvested it for decades.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, and it's a classic slur. You know, our side was motivated by virtuous motives, and their side was motivated by dirty, low
motives. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, there were. Not all naval officers, God knows, were saints, but I doubt that the U.S. Navy had any more sleazy officers than any other force of the era. So this Ludwell Johnson, you end up just feeling sorry for this guy and for many other neo-Confederates, because, they're just wretched people. I've heard a few of them interviewed, and they have this bitterness that depends on focusing only on a few issues during their beloved CW, and they have to not notice a lot of people. A lot of them, you know, have focused their hatred on me lately because I wrote a book of essays.
Because all you did was say they should have been hung. I mean, what's wrong with that?
What is this PC stuff?
Snowflakes. I have to ask you, because the Battle of Pleasant Hill was sort of the defining battle within the Red River campaign. Of course, listeners should know, John, of course, is from... Grew up in Pleasant Hill, at the suburb of the East Bay, East San Francisco Bay in California, and wrote a great comic memoir, Pleasant Hill. But did you come across this battle at all when you were younger?
Never. I think this whole campaign has been sort of dumped down the memory hole.
Yeah.
I do know that most people in Pleasant Hill at that time were from Texas and Oklahoma, especially Oklahoma, because they'd been brought in to work for the refinery up in Martinez. But right. I never heard anything about Pleasant Hill. I'd probably bet that it might have been named after that, but I don't know.
I wonder if one of the reasons why we don't know much about this battle, I mean, obviously there's no reason for Northerners to remember it. It's pretty embarrassing all around. I mean, 1864 was a strange year because the Confederacy should have collapsed, but actually they had some pretty big wins in 1864.
Yeah, far too many. They were fighting above their weight in an admittedly heroic but really stupid way.
And from the Confederacy side, I mean, unless you're from that region, I'm just trying to think why it's not known more. I mean, I'll bet you Texas Confederates remember it very well.
Yeah, I bet they do. But, East Texas in particular. I've always heard of East Texas as a very reactionary area, but I don't want to slur the whole region.
But your Deep South Confederates, in a sense, might not want to remember that quite as well because they weren't doing as well for the most part at that time. And, and ultimately what it had led to, I mean, it just meant that a bad Union commander was sent back to a very strategically important, far more strategically important, base that they'd already taken on the Mississippi. And so in a sense, like what it did was it secured that corner of Arklatex and preserved, I guess, that memory for that particular region.
Yeah.
But it didn't have any big strategic.
No, I think people in the Arklatex were at least able to hold their heads up. Like,
yes,
maybe the rest of our team lost, but, out there in left field, we won.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that's great. And we will post maps and including that photo you posted of the Red River, of the very mushy, shallow Red River. And it's red and it's a mushy. I guess they have very shallow boats to get through there.
Not shallow enough. I mean, a lot of them were carrying cannon that weighed several tons. And
right.
You can't really do that with that much river. They actually improvised and dammed up the little streams in many places and waited for them to rise, trusting the cannon to keep local guerrillas off until they thought they were high enough to ride, literally ride like a water park. Let the boards go, and then you could just ride up the current for a few hours.
Right. So, just a couple of points or observations, from the story that you told about this campaign. One of them is, you mentioned that there were some calling for turning it into a guerrilla war. Some have said maybe they should have turned it into a guerrilla war, and Lee was right not to, but I would also bet that the planter class, which really did run this war, the planter class, for exactly the reasons you mentioned, would not have wanted to turn this into a guerrilla war. Like, they were all for going all out, winning the war, but not if it affected their plantations.
Yeah, and there's a sense among the smarter members of that class that they could manage this.
Yeah.
Because the Union elite was a bunch of venal suckers. And
right.
They're kind of right.
Right. And the other thing is, looking at Banks is such a, as you said, his the way he would sort of fight a battle, kind of win it, or maybe not win it, but always retreat no matter the results. It reminds me of, as you said, of a lot of these Union generals, 61 to 63, and the difference, it's almost like somebody who's wealthier, who's got a company he's trying to hold on to or a pot of money he's trying to hold on to, he doesn't want to spend it all, risk it all. So he's always sort of like, is almost always kind of playing defensively.
Right.
Whereas the other side was gambling everything because they were really going for the win. I mean, it's a different kind of psychology. The richer, the richer, more powerful invader who's more about like, let's ultimately we'll win, so let's hold on to the wealth we have. And the other side was, you know, the Confederate side was betting it all.
Yep.
And trying to win.
And yeah, that was the only chance they had. And for a while, it worked.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that was great. Well, thanks again, John, for part 20 of the Warner US Civil War series on the Red River Campaign. Thanks again, everyone. Thanks, Brendan, and all of our subscribers. And talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.